I'm back after a 2-week forced hiatus of the podcast because, oh my goodness, Leo got sick and it wasn't anything major. I think it was probably COVID or a chest infection or something along those lines. But when I tell you that that child took the entire house down, oh my God. Ben's been off work, Millie's been off school. I have been continuing to work on the radio, but absolutely dying. Every time I laugh, I cough, but to the point where it sounds like I'm about to expire. So because of all of those things, I wasn't able to record or edit for the last 2 weeks. So I'm sorry about that, but I am delighted to be back. I will say, you can probably hear in my voice, I am not better, but I'm better enough to do this. And I've actually really missed it. How have you been? What's been going on with you? I'm trying to think what's happened with me. Probably very little, apart from lying in bed going, oh my God, I feel so ill, I want to be better. And typically what Leo did was he was like really poorly with it, whatever it was he had. Like, he didn't speak for about a week, wouldn't really eat anything, wouldn't drink. Like, he looked so ill, bless him. And then just as he took us all down with it, he then got better. So his energy came back, just as me and Ben had absolutely zero energy to deal with him, which I think is probably fairly classic toddler behaviour, isn't it? So we're all still a bit germy, but we are on the mend. And in amongst all of this, I had a speech and language workshop to do. So we had Leo's first speech and language appointment and they kind of discharged him, really. I don't really understand how it works, if I'm being completely honest. And his speech is delayed, but I wouldn't say hugely. So I'm not too concerned at the minute. And I don't know if it works the same where you are, but you can self-refer back where I am. So I'm not too concerned that they discharged him. But what they did say was that we could do a workshop online. So Leo went to sleep. I logged into the workshop, but still feeling really, really ill. I think I had like a nice jumper on the top and pajama bottoms on the bottom, because obviously you can only see the top of me. But unfortunately, I really hope they didn't notice. I kept nearly falling asleep in the Zoom, and that wasn't to say that I didn't care. It wasn't to say that I wasn't interested, because obviously I want to do everything I can to help Leo. But my God, I felt so ill. And you know when your eyes are going, do you ever used to get that in school at the end of the day? That's what I felt like. I was in school in a lesson and my eyes were going and my head kept bobbing up and I was like, oh my God, this is so embarrassing. But there was unfortunately very little I could do about it. So that's it. That's what you've missed with me, is germs and falling asleep in Leo's quite important speech and language workshop. So pat on the back for me. Excellent parenting there. Well done. So this week's episode is slightly different because I have a man on the podcast. And there is a good reason for this. So I have my friend and work colleague, Adam Whale, on the podcast this week. And the reason being, so he is a send dad. And I think maybe it might be nice to get some more dads on at some point, just to kind of get a different perspective on things. But the main reason that Adam is on this week is because today is World Prematurity Day. Well, I say today, if you're listening on the day that the podcast comes out, then it's Monday the 17th of November. So World Prematurity Day, and Adam's son Toby was born extremely early. He was born at 26 weeks, which, as you can imagine, led to quite serious health complications. And Adam has actually written a book called Dear Toby, which is all about his experience in the neonatal unit, which was for a really, really long time. So the book is out today. So I wanted to be supportive of Adam's book, but also to find out about his journey as a send dad. So we did chat about Adam and his wife Gemma's experience of spending so long with Toby in neonatal and all of the challenges and emotions that that brought up. Adam talked about how it felt finally being able to take Toby home after so long in the hospital, and also the fact that they were very aware that Toby being born so early and some of the other health complications that he had did increase the risk of autism or ADHD. So that's something they were kind of hyper-vigilant about. Adam talks about Toby's diagnosis of sensory processing disorder and what that means and what that looks like for them as a family. And amongst many other things, we talk about the differences in raising a neurodivergent child and a typical child, because that's what Adam and his wife are doing with Toby and their daughter Ruby. Me and Adam have known each other for years and years and years. We work together on the radio every morning, but this is completely different to the chat that we have on the radio and just arguing over what songs we're going to play and talking about silly things. And I was actually really excited to kind of have that deeper chat with Adam about his journey with Toby. So I really hope you enjoy it. Let's get into it. There is a man that has infiltrated this podcast. How's this happened? How have you crept through, Adam Whale?
I'm a man. Really? I'm a man. Thank you. That's the nicest thing anybody said to me for a long time. I've crept in because you delightfully and lovely gave me a nice invite to the podcast.
Well, yes, I did. And yes, technically, this is the Send Mum Club. But actually, I think sometimes it's nice to get a male perspective on things. You are only the second man who's ever featured on this podcast, yes. My husband Ben being the other one. Hopefully, this podcast recording will go a lot smoother than that one did, because it was utter chaos.
Oh, really?
The dog was barking, the Amazon man came to the door, the baby woke up, everything went terribly wrong. But this will be fine, I'm sure.
And the arguments? Were there arguments?
No, we didn't argue on the podcast. Have you? It's funny you asked that. We argued about doing the podcast.
Okay.
The first time we tried to record it, we just had to stop because we clearly hated each other. So it took two goes and then it was good. I've had some good feedback about it. But this will go smoothly and swimmingly. Now, Adam, you're here to talk about your son, Toby.
Yes. My beautiful boy.
I know Toby, but for those who don't, which will be the majority of people listening, just tell everyone what Toby's like. Like, what's he into? What kind of a kid is he?
So Toby is 8 years old and he's an absolute whirlwind of a boy.
He is.
He doesn't stop moving. He is, he's very bubbly. He loves a giggle. He likes to get outside and climb on things. He loves to go church bell ringing. That's his latest
Oh, really?
Obsession at the moment.
Amazing.
He loves playing with his sister. He loves all things fun. And he particularly, if there's one thing I have to say that he loves more than anything, it's food. He loves his food like his dad.
Well done, Toby.
Yeah.
One of my favourite things about Toby when he was younger was how much he was obsessed with my eldest Alfie.
Yeah.
Do you remember?
Yeah, he did take a shine to Alfie, didn't he? A big shine. I'm not sure it was so reciprocated, because Toby was a little bit obsessed with him.
No, but it was so nice.
It was very cute. He did always ask, like, where's Alfie? I don't know, mate. We're in the middle of Aldi. Can you ask that question maybe when we're going over to see Jem and her kids?
So the start of your journey was a particularly difficult one, wasn't it? Because of how early Toby was born.
It was an unexpected one, yeah, because Toby arrived at 26 weeks. He was born very unexpectedly, because my wife Gemma, also a gem, she had severe preeclampsia and something called HELLP syndrome. And it came quite out of the blue for us, even though she'd been suffering probably for a month, but we just didn't realise the symptoms. She had swollen legs, she had headaches, she had pains in her chest, and that all indicated, which we later found out to be severe preeclampsia, and her blood pressure was just out of control. So she went to the doctors when she was feeling particularly bad, and they said, oh, you've got to go straight to the hospital. And when I got to the hospital, they said, we're delivering your baby. And that was quite a scary sentence to hear, knowing that Toby was only 26 weeks and that they were gonna have a surgery and get him out. Because that was the only cure for my wife, which was surgery. Because without that, her blood pressure would have got too high and she might have had a stroke. And then that would have been a big problem for both her and Toby.
How much did he weigh when he was born?
He was a little one. He was 760 grams. So in old money, that's £1.11. So he was born.
That's crazy.
And I was the first one to see him because Gemma was in surgery. But it was just all so unexpected. And I remember when he was wheeled over to me and I just looked at him and I was like, oh my God, how can something so tiny be alive? And I didn't have any words. I remember the delivery team all looking at me going, go on, say those words. He's a cutie or what a gorgeous boy. But I had nothing because I was just in shock. And then within seconds, he was whisked off to NICU, to neonatal intensive care. And yeah.
And how long did he spend there?
In intensive care, he spent a long time before he went on to HDU. He spent a total of 142 days in hospital between the Liverpool Women's Hospital, the neonatal unit there, and Alderhay. He had to go to Alderhay as well halfway through for life-saving surgery because Toby was quite troublesome. That was the nickname that he was given, Troublesome Toby. He had necrotizing enterocolitis at that point, but in total, he had 3 resuscitations. He had 2 brain bleeds, IVH grade 2, which are intraventricular hemorrhages. So they have different grades, and grade 2 out of 4. He had sepsis. He had pneumonia. He had anything that on 11 blood transfusions, 4 lumbar punctures. So it was a difficult ride. It was a roller coaster. That's the term they use on a neonatal unit, a roller coaster. And it really was with Toby.
It's funny, isn't it? Because all of those medical terms that you've used, I bet you didn't know what any of those were before you had Toby. And all of a sudden, when you have a child with any kind of needs, all of a sudden that language becomes almost second nature to you, doesn't it? It becomes part of your everyday life.
Yeah, it had to on the neonatal unit, really, because knowledge is power. Although knowledge caused me to be very scared at times, knowing a little too much maybe wasn't healthy because you were just thinking, oh my God, how's he going to make it through this? But you have to be informed. So if you're on a neonatal unit, my top tips are to be there. That's a huge one. So many people find it so scary, and I did. I found it terrifying those first few days in intensive care with all the beeps and the alarms going off. I wanted to take flight, but you have got to fight because it's better for you in the long term. It's better for your baby. Knowledge is the other thing. You've got to be informed. You need to know really what you're up against, what you're facing, or what you can do to help your baby, because parents play such a pivotal role. And that's such an amazing thing nowadays in neonatal units. They are giving parents greater roles, giving them the chance to feed, a lot more chances to feed, to clean, and to also and just hold them more, have those cuddles, which really benefit both parent and baby. And it's just so important as a parent to feel involved, because it's so very easy to feel like a spectator in that situation.
Yeah, I can imagine. And I think I'm fortunate enough to have not been in that situation. But I think when I have been in hospital, not so much with Leo, I think I'm really good at advocating for Leo, but certainly when I was younger with my first baby, I think it's quite easy to fall into that trap of going, oh, well, I don't know, I don't understand. Yeah. These are doctors, this is their job. I'll just hand all of the power over to them. And to an extent, you do have to, but I know what you mean about being armed with that knowledge, because ultimately, you know your baby best.
Yes, you do learn to know your baby better than anyone else. And there were plenty of times we had to mention it to the medical team saying, oh, don't think he's well here, think he might be coming down with an infection. Or can you check this out? And they would. They were amazing. If you befriend the staff and are friendly, they want what you want, which is the best possible outcome, which is to get your baby healthy and out of there. But it is such an incredibly terrifying situation for those who haven't been through it. I've had 2 babies in neonatal unit, and second time around, we handled it a lot better. The first time, it was very difficult mentally for me, because you're sort of, as a man, conditioned not to let your feelings out. And I do recommend talking and letting them out, because it can build up and manifest in some problems in many different ways. So it is just a mad experience. But we were one of the lucky ones. He was so ill, and he could have lost his life. We were given 20% chance of survival when he had necrotizing enterocolitis. There was another time when his lungs began to fail and we had to stay the night. And we know that we were very, very lucky, because we managed to get our little boy home. But if he'd been born, you know what, anywhere else in the country, he might not have survived. Just the Liverpool Women's Hospital neonatal unit is just incredible. And the work they do at Alder Hey, which of course you know, Gem, they are amazing. They are just a top, top team.
I think it's interesting what you've said there. And of course, because it's predominantly women that come on this podcast, I haven't had these conversations with you kind of as a man feeling like you had to be the strong one, I guess, because I suppose from your perspective, yes, your baby's there, but your wife has just given birth. Not only just given birth, she's had major abdominal surgery to facilitate that birth happening. So I guess you are, although you're both coming at it as Toby's parents, you are coming at it from slightly different angles there, aren't you?
You are indeed, yeah. And I do feel like when we were on the unit, the mothers were sort of looked after a little bit more. It felt like that from the staff, and the dads weren't so much looked after. And whether that actually happened or not, I don't know. But it just felt like that. And it felt that we had to be the strong ones. We had to be stoic and not show our emotions. But looking back, that was exactly the wrong way to handle it. Letting those emotions out, letting yourself be vulnerable, enables people to know you better. And then the more you know people, the greater the trust you will have with those clinicians and the people around you. And I think it's really important as well to bond with fellow families who are going through it in the neonatal unit. We had our group of friends who we called the Neo Mates, and we're still in touch with loads of them today. And their support meant so much because it's an isolating experience. So whilst we are good friends and we were working together at the time, we don't see each other as much. I was still coming into work, but then literally I was going the moment the show finished because I wanted to be by Toby's side. And you don't go to social occasions, so it's quite isolating as a parent in a neonatal unit. You feel lonely. I remember one week I only got one text message, and that was from John Lewis, the department store, because Gemma, my wife, had ordered some wardrobes and everything for Toby once we were confident that he would survive. But I just felt quite lonely. And if it wasn't for the Neo Mates on the unit, then it would have been even harder. But I mean, it's probably difficult for someone like you to hear, because you're a friend, that you didn't realise how lonely I did feel. But inevitably, your social interactions do reduce as you spend your time next to your child. And it's just one of those things that happens. So I do always say to people, if somebody's going through something, somebody's in a tricky spot or isn't well, then just sending a message saying you're thinking of them does mean so much. It's huge.
I think it's hard as somebody outside that situation to know how much to contact, I guess, because you're going through, or you see someone that you care about going through something so extreme and so alien to anything that you've experienced before, you know, and unless you have been in a very similar situation. And it's hard to kind of, you want to support, but you also don't want to kind of bother somebody. You don't want to be, you know, texting or messaging, or it's extremely hard to know the line to walk, isn't it?
Yeah, I think asking questions can be great at times, but just sending those messages saying, look, thinking of you, sending all the positive thoughts, sending that love to you and the family. I think I would have been happily receiving that all the time, because then it felt like I had a bigger team behind us and people were actually sort of thinking of us and Toby. And I did know people were thinking of us and Toby, but it's just sometimes
I can confirm that everybody was thinking of you and Toby.
It's a strange experience where you are spending all your time and essentially your child is just lying there, like, I mean, what every baby does, but they're struggling for life, but they don't do much. And so all you're doing a lot of the time is sitting there and worrying and stressing, and just having those little messages when they did come through were amazing, and they meant so much. And it's what I would recommend to anybody who knows somebody going through the similar experience. Just send that message of just saying, look, I'm sending my love and sending positive thoughts. And it really will work wonders for that person. So yeah, 142 days in Alder Hey and the Liverpool Women's Hospital before we got him home. And those days, I look back on now, because we got him home, and I actually look back on quite fondly, and because we got him home and we managed to get through it, which was amazing. And don't get me wrong, there were some difficult times, but there were some funny times with your Neo mates. In the depths of despair, you can always find laughter, and you need dark humour to get through those situations.
When you did get him home, I would imagine, obviously, that would have been a really exciting time. And it's the start, I suppose, of, obviously you were parents, but it's the start, I suppose, of you being parents on your own terms, in your own space, in your own house. And obviously, that's a huge, huge milestone for you, given everything that you'd been through. But was there an element of, like, were you scared?
Yeah, of course we were scared.
Well, as well.
Well, one, he was hooked up to oxygen. We were worrying about blowing up the house and the baby, if because the oxygen cable went around the whole house. And so we could effectively take him into the kitchen, but obviously the gas cooker and oxygen wouldn't mix, so we didn't want to take him in there. We did have a gas fire, so we didn't turn that on. In fact, we got that disconnected. But yes, we were quite scared because we didn't have the nurses around us. And he was on oxygen and he needed that oxygen still. If he didn't have that oxygen, he would have turned blue and who knows what would have happened and passed out. In fact, there was one occasion where my wife forgot to turn it on at night and there was a moment where I was like, I can't hear the oxygen. I can't hear it. Turn the light on and it was a bit blue. And we were like, oh no, he still needs the oxygen. But it is scary when they've needed so much medical care because you're always sort of prepared and on the lookout for either an infection or some complication. So yeah, I think it's even more terrifying. Although I do think parents who take their firstborns home on the day, that's just as terrifying because at least we had months to figure out how Toby likes being held, how we can burp him, how we can feed him. Whereas parents who take their babies home just on that first day, it's for me mind blowing because it's like you don't know anything about this baby. You've got to figure it out. It's like flat pack IKEA furniture. How the hell do we get this together?
Yeah, but cuter. I agree with you. And I think it's nice of you to say that, but I would have to disagree with you there because I think bringing home a newborn baby that has no medical issues that you're aware of, you're not expecting anything to go wrong.
Yeah.
Yes, of course, you're going to shit yourself and be like, don't know what I'm doing. Yeah. But you're not waiting for something bad to happen.
Yeah.
Or you might feel anxious, but I mean, you were potentially waiting for something bad to happen because bad things had happened.
Yes. And I guess we were on edge as a result. But when you've got both of you together and you really support one another, and I think myself and my wife's relationship was incredible at that stage. And it still is incredible, by the way. Sometimes.
Just to clarify.
Sometimes. We were really a team, a united duo, and we really helped each other through that scenario. And we didn't allow each other to feel like they were the one who was putting in more work at home or looking after Toby more. I mean, I was quite lucky because I, obviously, doing a breakfast show, I was up early. I was able to do the feed before I went to work. And then I came back early and I was able to relieve my wife of the Toby duty and let her have a nap whilst me and Toby went and did things. So we were very much in it together and splitting up the duties.
I'm going to fast forward a little bit. I don't know how much I'm fast forwarding here. So you can tell me.
Yeah.
So you're home with Toby. At what point did you first start to suspect or notice behaviour that maybe wasn't so typical?
My wife and I were both hypervigilant because we were both aware that the early birth that Toby had and the complications due to necrotizing enterocolitis where he had the surgery and also the brain bleeds, we were always looking for it. But it was my wife who really sort of thought, oh, hang on a second here. I'm noticing sort of a pattern when we take Toby places. When he started walking, really, he just was a sensory seeker. And he was always, if you took him to a new place, he would run off or try and touch everything and pick everything up. And we looked into it a bit, but it was Gemma, my wife, who then pushed that with his neurologist. and said, look, I think he's got sensory processing disorder. Everything sort of matches up. And they at the time thought, oh, maybe it's ADHD maybe. But then they really also, after a little while and an assessment, decided that, yes, they think it was SPD. And so that was our first sort of diagnosis that led us onto the path of becoming a family with a neurodivergent child. And
how old was he when you got that diagnosis?
He was four. We put him a year back, in fact, at school, because his birthday was June, mid-June, and he should have been born late September. We noticed that there was a bit of a delay with Toby. And I mean, it's perfectly normal for babies, premature babies especially, to do their milestones a little bit later. I mean, every child is different, aren't they? Even some of the summer babies who aren't neurodivergent or who aren't preemies, they could fare better if they were put in the year behind.
Yeah, 100%, because really, you could have two children, you know, typical children or not, who were almost a year apart starting school at the same time. So the child who is a year older typically is gonna find things a bit easier,
yeah,
aren't
yeah,
they?
Definitely. It makes a big difference, doesn't it, at that age?
100%.
It makes a huge difference. So yeah, we did decide to put Toby behind a year, and it's been the best thing for him. So we noticed it was around four that's when we really sort of were thinking it. And my wife pushed it, and I think she did a really good job getting the sensory processing disorder diagnosis. And then we could see other traits coming in. And the nursery that Toby was at were just amazing. And they helped us pursue an EHCP before Toby went to school. And thankfully, he was under the care of neurology, also ophthalmology and audiology at Alder Hey. And so we had a lot of evidence to support the EHCP. We had to get something from his speech therapist as well, his physiotherapist. They're quite hard to put together, really, in EHCP, but they're so important to help a child flourish within education. And I think getting that EHCP has just really changed his whole school life.
And was the EHCP initially just for the sensory processing disorder?
Yeah, because he was getting assessed and on the pathway for an ASD diagnosis. And at first, the school didn't really believe or think that he was autistic, but we had to sort of push it a little bit, and he had to go for an assessment within Alder Hey. And Toby, I guess they were saying it because he's such a sociable little boy. He's quite high functioning. He was delayed with his speech, but his speech has come. He doesn't stop talking now. Just stop, Toby, please. Come on. Stop gabbing.
I don't know where he gets that from.
Yes, just waffling on like his dad. We sort of thought, no, there are some other traits. He gets very fixated on things, hyper-fixated, and he doesn't let them go. And we noticed that was a trait. I mean, the spectrum is so vast, isn't it? That it's not one size fits all. Everybody's very different. And thankfully, with the assessment, he was in overdrive. He was getting hyperfixated when he was assessed by some of the medical equipment that he'd seen outside. And he wouldn't let the assessor continue the assessment until she had explained it or let him see the equipment. For him to be able to then move on and his mind to then think about other things. Yeah, he got his diagnosis when he was about five and a half. So he was obviously in school. It didn't change much in terms of what the school were doing, the SEND team, because they were already fantastic, because he had that EHCP in place. He already got his one-to-one tuition, so he has a teaching assistant, and thankfully he's the only one in the classroom that needs the teaching assistant, and so that has been so helpful for his concentration, because his concentration isn't the greatest when it comes to schoolwork. I mean, it can be incredible when he gets hyperfixated on things. Currently, his hyperfixations Oh, church bells. He absolutely loves church bells. We have to take him bell rigging now and again, but then he can get too focused on that. His security cameras. He loves security cameras. Sometimes we have to watch YouTube footage of security cameras and he has to just be in charge and tell me if he sees anybody on the camera, speakers.
It sounds like quite a fun game. Yeah. I'd quite like to play that. And to be fair, so do the church bells.
Yeah. He's there's a couple of TV shows he's become hyper-fixated on, but some of it it's actually worked out really well. Like there's a TV show called Ladybug and Miraculous.
Oh, yeah.
And he's just become so creative as a result. There's a miracle box and you've got loads of what they call Kwamis in the show. And he's been making them all and designing them. And he's made his own miracle box and he's just become so hyper fixated. But it's so good for his coordination because his fine motor isn't very good. I mean, that's a result of his brain bleeds and his early starts, but also children with autism and sensory processing disorder, their fine motor skills don't tend to be as great. And so we're trying to do everything we can to help those fine and gross motor skills. His gross motor skills are really good now. He's got a massive climbing frame in his garden where he can just do the monkey bars over and over again. He's very strong, you know. He's almost stronger than me, but that is because I'm particularly weak, isn't it? So obviously he's had physio as well when he was young, and his physical development has just come on leaps and bounds. And you would never know that he was born so early and had all those problems. But if you delve deeper into Toby, then you find out that he is neurodivergent, then you might start to see them. But he's one of those where you could spend a bit of time with him and you wouldn't really know, actually, and think that he's on the ASD pathway and that he is neurodivergent. Some days, though, actually, you could spend a minute in his time and you'd go, oh, my God, this boy's just hyperfixating on everything.
I'm going to be honest, I actually wasn't aware that there was a higher chance of autism in children that were premature. Did you find that out when he was in hospital, or is that something that you, through your own kind of research, came upon?
A bit of research and a little bit of his of finding out since he left hospital with his neurologist. The earlier you're born as a preemie, then the higher the chances of certain complications. And unfortunately for Toby, also suffering from necrotizing enterocolitis and his brain bleeds meant that there was certainly an increased chance of him being neurodivergent and him on...
Well, I've actually got the stats here because I was interested to know how much that does increase a chance of autism. So this was a huge study that was done in Sweden. It was records of more than 4 million people born in Sweden between 1973 and 2013. So 6% of babies born between 22 and 27 weeks went on to be diagnosed with autism. 2.6% of babies between 28 and 33 weeks goes down to 2% between 34 and 36. But then, to be honest, it's not considerably lower for babies that were born on time, because it was still 1.4% of babies who were born at 40 weeks.
Yeah. I don't want to worry anybody who's had a preemie, because I mean, that is, they're low percentages, but unfortunately...
I think that's why I was keen to read those percentages, because the highest percentage is 6%.
Yeah.
And the kind of base is 1.4% anyway. Yeah. So yes, it's slightly raised, but it isn't significantly raised, is it, really?
Yeah, Toby's chances were increased, as I say, because of his the surgery that he had and the necrotizing enterocolitis. But as parents, myself and my wife, we've always sort of been proactive and looking at Toby and thinking, oh, if he is on the ASD pathway, if he is autistic, if he does have ADHD, that we should always think about what would be best for Toby and how we could help him, because it doesn't make a blind bit of difference to us if he is autistic or does have ADHD. We just want to do the right thing for him. We want Toby to become the best version of himself, because he unfortunately didn't have the best start. So we are trying to do everything that we can to make sure our son becomes the Toby, the best version of him, the best Toby that he could be. And we want to help him as much as possible. I mean, I have heard stories of parents who are hesitant to get the assessments for autism and ADHD. What will happen? They either get diagnosed or they don't. And if they do get diagnosed, then they will get all the help that they will need to become the best versions of themselves.
I suppose pursuing a diagnosis is, it must be littered with emotions, that, because yes, of course, you would always want your child to have all of the support and all of the help that they would need. But I can imagine that it might be quite conflicting if in your head you're kind of hoping that that's not the case.
Yeah.
Because I suppose you're pursuing information that the likelihood is you would not want to be the case.
Yeah, I understand that. But I mean, I think we were slightly different because we were aware that there could be problems, and that we were aware that he had had that rough start, and we just wanted to make sure that nothing was missed and that he could then therefore get the help and the support as soon as possible, instead of delaying that support. And having that support within school has made the world of difference to his handwriting, his speech, and also socially for him. Being able to keep up with his peers has just been incredible for our little boy.
This might be a difficult question for you to answer, because I suppose you wouldn't know either way, but do you think Toby's start in life impacted how you dealt with that diagnosis?
Yeah, definitely.
Well, the diagnoses.
Well, Toby's start to life, yeah, meant that we were sort of aware that it was a greater possibility. And so therefore, we'd almost on the path to acceptance, or if and an understanding. Whereas if he had been full term, then we wouldn't have been looking out for it or aware and understood that there was a greater chance of him being autistic. And by the way, he hasn't got his ADHD diagnosis yet, but he is on the pathway. And
do you think then that you were, as well as watching out for it, do you think that maybe you were kind of waiting for it as well?
Yeah, well, I guess we were sort of watching out for it, but we sort of, after he had the sensory processing diagnosis, disorder diagnosis, we knew that then there was a greater chance that he would then be diagnosed with autism and ADHD. And so I guess having been already under the care of neurology and the other departments, that we were just positioned ourselves that we were going to accept anything that he had been diagnosed with. And I'm just waffling, and I'm sorry, Gem.
No, you're not waffling at all. You're making perfect sense. You do waffle a lot in life, but you're not doing that now.
I feel like I'm waffling, and I really hope it's so difficult, isn't it? This, I'll be honest with you, I find it really difficult not to to talk to people about Toby's diagnosis and to say that he's been diagnosed with autism or is on the getting assessed for ADHD. That's absolutely fine. I'm just so wary when you talk to fellow parents, or you're on a podcast for parents for children who are neurodivergent, and you're so worried about saying the wrong thing. And so worried about worrying people. So it's really difficult, to be honest. Like, I want to be able to say, it doesn't matter if your child obviously is neurodivergent or neurotypical. It doesn't matter. This, for me, is a huge thing. We have a neurotypical child. We have a neurodivergent child. They're both equally amazing. But I always find it difficult to talk to people who don't have neuro neurodivergent children about neurodivergent children, because I think they'll never sort of fully understand. But I am.
Well, I think that's kind of the point of this podcast. Yeah. And, you know, if this is your first time listening, this is for all kinds of additional needs. And I do talk to a lot of parents, you know, with children with autism and, you know, who are neurodivergent, but also I've spoken to, you know, parents of children with limb differences and sight differences. And, this is across the board. But what you've just said is true for all of that, because you don't understand until it's you. And I think you can try and be supportive and you can try and understand, but you don't understand until it's you, because how could you possibly understand what it's like to be raising a child with additional needs? And yes, everything is a spectrum. Leo's Down syndrome is the same. You know, he can meet other children with Down syndrome who will be completely different to him, because it's not a one size fits all, the same as with autism. Well, the same with everything, really, isn't it? But I think it's nice to feel like there is a community there of supportive people who get it, even if they don't get the exact minute details of your situation. They get what it's like to be raising a child with additional needs and the challenges that that brings. And I do think it's incredibly important as well to kind of acknowledge that sometimes it's really bloody hard. And I don't know, you might not feel this, Adam, but sometimes it makes me feel sad just because it's a thing. Does that make sense? Like, nothing, sometimes something doesn't have to happen. Leo doesn't have to have had a specific challenge or, you know, an appointment that hasn't gone well. Sometimes I'm just like, oh, this is just feels shit, doesn't it? Was it us?
Yes, well, sometimes it is shit. Let's face it, sometimes it is shit, because it can be very difficult. I mean, we love our children so much, and obviously equally, but things can be more difficult and in ways you never expect when children with autism or ADHD, when they go to school, they do a lot of something called masking. So they're trying to fit in and not show necessarily all their behaviours and every day, well, not every day, but some days when Toby comes home, he just blows. And we find that difficult. And you're just, but I mean, they do say, a lot of people say they feel comfortable to do that at home. So they let it all out. And so that I have to hold on to that each time when Toby comes home and he gets really sort of just angry because he's had to hold in all these emotions throughout the day. There are times when we want to do something and trying to just sit down and concentrate, and Toby, bless him, he can't concentrate for too long sometimes, and he has to get up and move. He needs that proprioception. And you're like, oh my God, just please, just stay there, sit down. And then you're looking at your neurotypical child, Ruby, and she's just there, just concentrating away. There are times when you're going shopping and he just wants to seek everything and touch everything. And people looking at you as we're running around Aldi because he's trying to touch everything and look at everything. You're worried that people are judging you. And you're in those moments, you're like, oh God, this is difficult. There are just so many differences that you don't realize. Sleep is found harder for my son. We don't get much sleep in our house. Fingers crossed that will change at some point. It's just all these things you don't realise. There is obviously just so many amazing moments of joy with children who have got autism and ADHD. Toby's hyperfixations, they do bring us a lot of joy when we're all having fun watching him as he's going absolutely crazy, when he's doing the bell ringing, when he's just talking to us and about these things which he loves so much and he's so knowledgeable about, because he just hyperfixates on them. It is such a different path to what I knew before I was a parent. There is a big difference from when I remember seeing my brother's children to my own children, just with the way you parent and everything. And I think you have to put in a lot more work, in a way, for a neurotypical child, a neurodivergent child, sorry, than a neurotypical, because you just don't understand that there's so many aspects to it, like the fine motor skills you've really got to help, like the gross motor skills that you've really got to help, like the extra work you need for speech, like the extra work you need for holding that pencil, like the extra work you need to be able to sit and concentrate and read a book, and just even playing games, because they can have PDA, they can have a pathological demand avoidance and not want to play or do those things because they might lose, because they might not get it right first time. We have so many more frustrations with Toby when doing things. Not us, sorry. He has the frustrations because he can't get it exactly right. But it does get better and it does get easier, definitely, as you put in the work. But I feel like as a parent of a neurodivergent child, I think you do have to work that much harder compared to a child who is neurotypical, because our daughter Ruby, she just gets things first time. But Toby, you have to show and repeat and show and repeat and show and repeat, and they find it harder. And that's not their fault in any way, shape or form. It's just how their bodies are, and they need that extra help. And it does make it that much harder.
So, Adam, you are not only a dad and a husband and a radio presenter, but you are also an author now.
Yes, unbelievably, I am an author. So I never thought I'd write a book, but I didn't have such an amazing story to tell. And Dear Toby, The Diary of a Preemie Parent is the book I have written. It's the story of Toby's 142 days in hospital and also a guide for parents on the neonatal roller coaster. So I started writing it to get my emotions out, because I didn't want to show people my emotions, because I thought that would be a weakness, which is the wrong way to think. Getting your emotions out is a strength, not a weakness. So I wrote it down, and then everything that was happening, I wanted to know what was going on. So I continued writing it. And then I thought it might help parents going through it, because I could find nothing that had been written by a parent about the neonatal journey that I could connect with. And so I continued writing it. And it's for all the parents who are going through their own neonatal journey, because it's going to be released on World Prematurity Day, which is today.
Well, that's today.
Today. This is it's book release day.
We might not
day.
Be talking what, today,
what
but
am
by the
I
time
doing?
It comes out, it will be today.
What am I doing here? I should be releasing my book. it's for parents who are also going through that neonatal journey, to help guide them through it, to help them understand that they're not alone, that you could feel this way, you could feel that way. Also to help them understand bits of why we should do bonding, of why we should do cuddles, of why we should be there looking out for our babies. It includes things like something called EPID, which is something I've coined, by the way. It's something I came up with, early parental infection detection, because infection is the enemy of a neonate. So there's ways that you can look out for that. But yeah, it's also a love letter to my son, and also to those who work within neonatal units up and down across the country, because, oh my God, what a difficult job. It must be so hard. There must be moments of pure joy, but also pure anguish, because there were a few babies along Toby's way who were his friends within the neonatal units who unfortunately didn't make it out, and they didn't come home. It's also a book for them to remember their names as well, because we should never forget those and never be afraid to say the names of those who unfortunately haven't made it. I hope it makes a difference to parents going on that neonatal journey. And I hope it makes a difference to those who have been on the journey, who maybe didn't put all their emotions down, and they can also reflect when reading it, and hopefully connect with it. And a portion of the proceeds are going to Alder Hey and the neonatal unit at the Liverpool Women's Hospital to say
thanks. I think that's lovely. And I think the way that you've just spoken about it and who it's for and the reasons why you wrote it are absolutely beautiful. So congratulations on your book, which by the time this goes out, is out now.
I don't know.
How exciting.
Go and read it.
So I know there's a website. There's also a link to buy, and those links are going to be in the show notes. But Adam, I finished the podcast in the same way with every guest.
Yes.
By asking the same two questions.
Okay.
The first of which is, what is the best piece of advice you've been given along the way?
What is the best piece of advice I've been given along Toby's journey? Don't look at what he can't do. Look at what he can do is the best piece of advice I've been given, because we are so conditioned to go, oh, but they can't do that. They can't do that. Look at the way he's holding his pen or not able to do this. Don't look at it like that. Look at what they can do, because they can do so many amazing things and they are incredible and amazing. So celebrate what they can do and don't get fixated on what they can't do.
Can you remember who it was that told you that?
I think it was my wife.
I'm not sure. You should definitely give her the credit for that.
Yeah, I'm giving my wife the credit for that. I'm not sure who she heard it from or whether she came up with it by herself. But I remember when she told me that and I was like, oh my God, you're right. You know what? You're completely right. And it sort of changes your mindset a little bit. You're not there going, oh, but they can't do this. And I really want them to do that. You're there thinking, oh my God. Look what you've just done. Look what you can do. You're incredible.
Yeah, it's great advice, that. And my final question is, what do you know now that you wish you'd known when you got, well, any either of those diagnoses that Toby's got?
I wish that I didn't compare Toby to others, because I was very good at doing that, if I'm honest with you, or bad, as it might be, because you're always comparing your child to others in a way, milestones and seeing how they are at school. But it's something that I don't think you should do at all. You shouldn't be comparing your neurodivergent child to a neurotypical one, because they will do things differently and they will do things in their own time. So not comparing your child to others is something that I wish I had known from the beginning of the journey, because I did get quite fixated on that at times. Oh my God, but look, they can do this and they can do that. And I wish I hadn't, because my son can do these things now as he's getting older. He's learning and he's, his coordination's just becoming so much better. And I'm not comparing him to others, because he is amazing. I don't need to compare him to others, because he's the best sometimes.
Well, what a lovely, until you said sometimes, what a lovely way to finish.
I say sometimes.
A great way to finish on.
I say sometimes just because he doesn't sleep too well, and I find and I wish that he was better at sleeping. That's the one. In fact,
he's the best in the daytime.
He's best in the daytime. Nighttime, he's down right at the bottom. I do still compare him to others when it comes to sleep, but other than that, I don't.
And that's okay. That's okay, Adam. Listen, thank you for being only the second ever man to be on the podcast.
Okay.
It was really nice to chat to you, to get kind of a different experience of being a SEND parent. And thank you for being so honest.
No worries. Second and last man, probably, after my appearance.
No, you won't be.
Lovely to talk, as always. It's not often that I talk so in depth about Toby and his neurodivergence. And if it can help anyone who's on the path to a diagnosis, or anyone relates to the way I feel, then and makes them feel better in any way, then I'm just very happy to have chatted with you.
Well, same. Congratulations again on the book.
Out now.
Which is out now.
Out now. Dear Toby, the Diary of a Preemie Parent. Dear Toby, the Diary of a Preemie Parent. Of course, you can get it from Amazon. You can get it online at Waterstones. And I'm sure you're going to put up some links, aren't you? Please.
I will. Yeah, the links will be in the show notes. And I will see you on the radio tomorrow morning when we will reconvene In Demand Decades, brand new breakfast show. If you're not in Liverpool, you can get the app. There you go.
Do it. Listen.
Perfect. Oh my God, if there was ever a time that I wished I hadn't pressed stop recording when I did, it would be then, because me and Adam carried on chatting for a minute and his wife Gemma came in and she's like, why have you stolen all my lamps and put them in front of your face? And it was because he was trying to get some good lighting for the social clips. And honestly, I wish I could have seen it from her perspective, because I now know that he was sat there in his little office setup upstairs with a load of her lamps in front of him, which just really made me chuckle. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed that episode. I know it's weird having a man on the Send Mum Club, isn't it? But I also kind of like it. It's nice to hear a different perspective. And I thought actually it was really interesting hearing what Adam said about how he felt how when Toby was still in the neonatal unit, about how he had to be the strong one and be stoic and not show his emotions, and how in hindsight he'd realised that that wasn't the right thing to do. And I think him writing the book and the way that he speaks about it is absolutely beautiful. So Dear Toby is out now. I actually can't wait to read it. I haven't got a copy yet. I was hoping Adam might give me one, but since he hasn't, I'll be ordering it off Amazon. And like I said, the link for that will be in the show notes. Okay, so that is it for another episode of the Send Mum Club. I promise it will be a mum, it will be a woman on next, because I've actually got a bank of brilliant recordings of amazing women that I've spoken to. So one of those will be here for you next week. And in the meantime, as always, if you would like to subscribe, rate, review, all of those nice things, I'd really appreciate it. If you want to drop me a message, I am at the Send Mum Club on Instagram. Give us a follow if you're not already. You can see little clips of all of the previous episodes. You can message me about question suggestions, about guest suggestions. You can suggest yourself. Whatever it is, I would love to hear from you, and I will see you next week.